Hello, everyone. I'm John Melke, and this is Parkside Today. I'm joined by UW Parkside Associate Professor of Biological Sciences, Dr. Christopher Noto. Taking a quick look at Dr. Noto's webpage, you'll find out that he grew up in upstate New York and developed a passion for fossils and natural history at an early age. Search the UW Parkside website, and you'll find stories about Dr. Noto's involvement with crocodile fossil discoveries in, of all places, the heart of the Dallas Metroplex. Most recently, Dr. Noto was featured on the National Geographic website in a story about an oddball, and that's National Geographic's word in the headline, not mine, crocodile relative. So, Chris, welcome to Parkside Today.
Thanks for having me.
And I've been practicing, but I know that I'm going to mess up the official names. So tell us about Scolomastax. How did I do on that?
Close.
Okay.
It's Scolomastax.
Scolomastax.
So actually, I can tell you what the name means.
Yeah.
Scolomastax is Greek, and skolos is Greek for anything pointed.
Hmm.
Mastax means jaw or mouth. So the piece that we have of this animal is actually just one half, the right half of the lower jaw.
Mm,
and that part comes to a very tapered point. And so that's where we got the name from. That's where the name comes from. And then the species name.
And that's going to be the second part.
Yes.
That's what you're gonna, and I was just going to say, help me with the second part.
So the species name is Salstenai because it's named after a longtime volunteer and co-discoverer of our dig site named Art Salstein. So this was named in his honor because of the enormous contributions he has made to the dig site and this project, as well as the fact that he actually discovered this particular specimen.
Okay, so and we want, I also want to get into a few years ago when there was another discovery that you made in the area, but tell us about this oddball guy. He's a little smaller than what we're going to talk about in a little bit. And how did you come across this particular species?
So this is a really interesting little croc. It's I like to say it's about the size of a small dog in terms of like weight. It was probably about 3 to 5 feet long. And it is very unique because this jaw piece that we have shows that it was a very short-snouted animal. And that that short snout had very few teeth, and those teeth actually had different shapes. And we can tell that because we can look at the shape of the tooth sockets.
Okay.
And the shape of the tooth socket closely follows the general shape of the tooth. So circular shapes are going to be a more conical, cone-shaped tooth, and then the ones more towards the back of the mouth become a lot more square.
Okay.
And those are associated with teeth that are used for grinding or crushing. So this animal is what we call a heterodont, is that in that the teeth are very different shapes. Other interesting things is that portions of this jaw have additional enlarged attachments for muscles.
Okay.
So they have these extra ridges and crests and things that the jaw closing muscles would attach to. And what this tells us is that it had a very powerful, very strong bite, but not like we think of with living crocodiles and alligators. This is more likely associated when you add up all these different features with it consuming hard food items. So crunching things like snail shells or little bits of bone or even possibly plants. There's some evidence when we compare what we know about Scolomastax to living extinct reptiles that may have some of the similar features.
Okay.
Those animals are known to engage in omnivory, in eating both plant and animal. part. So
okay.
The Scolomastex may have been a jack of all trades as far as its diet is concerned.
Yeah. Now, so let's go back a few years to when you have another discovery in the same area of Arlington, Texas. And again, you're going to have to help me here. I'll do my best with the, I'll try Delta Sutis.
Again, really close. Well, you know, it's you can just say it's all Greek to me.
Yeah.
Because it is. Yeah. It's Delta Sucus.
Delta Sucus. Okay.
So that's named for the ancient environment where all these animals were living, these organisms were living, was once a vast delta plain similar to what you might see in the end of the Mississippi River.
Mm-hmm.
So delta is in response to that, and the Sucus part is a typical Greek word for crocodile.
Okay. And how about the species name?
Mother all eye. So
the mother of all crocodiles.
That is one thing. That's one thing we've called it. Actually, this is another species that is named after a volunteer from the Archosaur site who initially uncovered the first material belonging to this species. This volunteer's name is Austin Motherall, and he was actually just a teenager at the time that he discovered it when he was volunteering.
Wow. Talk a little bit about the fact that the Dallas Metroplex, the Arlington area that we see today, is much, much different than what that area of the Earth looked like 90 to 100 million years ago, and how is it different?
So if we go back in time, to when the Archosaur site was being deposited. That is a period of time during the Cretaceous period when sea levels were very, very high.
Mm.
And so not only were sea levels high, but the position of the continents was slightly more south. So North America was actually closer to the equator than it is today.
Okay.
With the high sea level, that actually split North America into two separate land masses. So on the western side, we have a land mass that is referred to as Laramidia, mm-hmm. and on the eastern side, that land mass is referred to as Appalachia. So the Archosaur site is a part of Appalachia. It was a peninsula jutting out into this warm, shallow sea.
Hmm.
So this is the only terrestrial, the only rock representing land, all the organisms and things, all the stuff that was happening on land, because you have all this sea everywhere else around it. So one of the things that makes it so important and why we happen to find this kind of an environment with these kinds of organisms in this place is because this is where that specific terrestrial rock happens to be jutting out in this part of Texas. So we kind of have the right place at the right time and just happens to be under one of the largest metropolitan areas in the United States.
Yeah. What, and the, you talked about the sea. Are we talking saltwater, freshwater?
Saltwater. Going back this time, 95 to 100 million years ago, this was a shallow sea. So yeah, salt water with marine organisms and things like that. One of the interesting things is that the Archosaur site does carry a mixture of animals that we know should have inhabited salt water and some that inhabited freshwater or brackish mixed water. And what this tells us is that we are very close to the shore. We're in a marginal community that allows, at least in certain periods of time, the mixing of some marine organisms and some freshwater organisms.
Mm-hmm. How did this area, and you touched on some of the people who discovered this, how did the discovery initially take place?
So we got to go back over 15 years when you had multiple individuals, including Art Salstein, who are amateur paleontologists, and they love to walk around and look for things on the rock exposures that are around the Metroplex.
Hmm.
Art happens to live right over the hill, about a stone's throw away from our site. This site,
wow.
And he was walking along there, with his daughter, and discovered a dinosaur bone. In fact, she sat on it, or so the story goes.
And is something like that, like let's say the average person is walking in the same place, would they have known what that was, or was it because of the fact that this person had an interest in the field that they were able to go, you know, this is something, this isn't just something sitting here, this is something that we need to pay attention to?
Well, you know, it depends. Sometimes it's very easy to tell that something is a fossil, and these are obviously bones, and they're actually very large, so it's pretty easy to tell that something has a bony shape, something recognizable like a limb bone, versus perhaps just a rock. But it can be difficult. Some of it is a trained eye, and sometimes people just happen to stumble upon something that is more easily recognizable.
Right.
Art is an enthusiast, so already had a bit of an eye for it.
Sure.
At the time.
Sure. And then how does the site continue to be developed over time?
So the site sits on private land, and actually, when this site was discovered, Art and there were some other university students that had independently stumbled upon it as well.
Hmm.
And they brought it to the attention of some of the local academic researchers. But the problem is the land, the original landowner would not allow any access, would not allow formal excavation to take place. And so we have to fast forward to 2007, when the land changed hands and was bought by a development company.
Okay.
And this development company then did allow access and excavation to begin.
Okay.
And so there's a bunch of time where we knew, you know, the site was known, but no real work was being done there.
But because of the previous owners prohibiting
it. Right, exactly. It's private land, and you know, that's their choice.
Why do you think they would prohibit it? Was there a reason that they didn't want to do it?
Liability,
you know?
I think.
Oh.
They just don't want. They didn't want to have to deal with anything possibly going wrong. In any case, the landowners were going to develop this into a planned community, basically a giant suburb that sits between Dallas and Fort Worth, and housing in the area is incredibly hot, and so they will build housing, you know, wherever they can.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there for a long time, the development was pretty far from where we were working, but gradually has been growing closer and closer and closer, to the point now where there is somebody's backyard who abuts next to, but not into. I should be clear. It's next to, but it is not part of that person's property. But yeah, you can go in someone's backyard and you could see where we did all our work from there.
Wow. And what are the chances that the people's backyard is also sitting on you would, is it just in that area, or could it be spread out further?
Well, probably not, because most of the fossil rich layer had been removed previously back in like the 60s or the 70s, when that whole area was used as a gravel pit. And then they added like another 6 feet of fill in order to before they started doing the development there. So
wow,
probably not.
Wow. And how does Christopher Noto get involved with this project? When do you come onto the scene in this site?
So back around 2008, 2009, I started getting having contact with a graduate student at University of Texas Arlington named Derek Main.
Okay.
And he was the person who kind of took over or took on this project of excavating this site.
Mm-hmm.
And it started small, and then it began to snowball from there. Then in 2009, Austin Motherall uncovered the first remains of Deltasuchus, and as they started to work, they realized that they had a very large collection of bones. And after that, things really began to take off. And Derek realized that he needed a lot more help, especially from other paleontologists, to properly work on this site, because there weren't many other paleontologists in his department that he could work with, at least not ones that have a background in working with bones, basically, vertebrates, animals with backbones and things like that. And we had already been working on a couple of other little projects, and so he said, hey, you know, you want to come down and help out with this, check it out? I was just finished my PhD and was looking for new opportunities, and so it was kind of perfect. And I said, yep, and I trekked down there and was blown away by what I saw, and I've been working there ever since. Now, you had asked about the Scolomastax in particular, how we came about that, and that's actually another funny story. Well, sad, then kind of funny. In 2013, Derek unexpectedly passed away. He had completed his dissertation on the Archosaur site and had done a lot of work on it. But the university was not capable of taking on the responsibility of curating and studying this vast collection. So I stepped in as the new director of the site, as the other primary collaborator, and brokered a deal with the Perot Museum of Nature and Science, which is located in Dallas, to take on the collection. So we had to pack up and transfer over 2,000 individual specimens.
Wow.
At the time.
Wow.
And while we were going through, I was having myself and volunteers and just so many different people had come out to help with this. We were cataloging and trying to, you know, make as complete a list of everything that, that we had at the time. Wow. And I came across this small box with this little jaw in it, and it was labeled as juvenile croc. Because at that time, all we had was Deltasuchus.
Okay, and Deltasuchus, this guy's big.
Yes.
Right?
And we do have, and we definitely know that there were juvenile baby Deltasuchus preserved at the same site.
Okay.
So it was reasonable, you know, if you see this little piece, you know, to say, hey, you know.
That's what you have.
And you move on because there's always more stuff to work on.
Sure,
but,
sure.
I know. I realized that this. I looked at it, and right away I realized that this was not juvenile Deltasuchus.
Okay.
And that started off a whole odyssey for many years of me talking to other specialists, trying to figure out what this thing is. I went back and forth from like, is it maybe a lizard or was it actually maybe even a mammal? Because it's morphology, all the pieces of it just it were so weird and different.
Wow.
And finally, after talking to enough experts and getting feedback, we decided that this was definitely a type of fossil relative of living crocodiles and alligators.
And but not a Deltasuchus.
Definitely not Deltasuchus. Yeah, that it was something completely new.
Yeah.
I was very excited by that because it was my my first opportunity to name a new species.
Oh, my gosh. That's fantastic. And that was one of the things I was wondering about before getting ready for the show is to, as you're working the site and you know that you're pursuing Deltasuchus, did you know that there was something else there that you were also looking for? And it sounds like you did.
And you know, the funny thing is, it's not just Deltasuchus. And we knew that there had to be, at least some other medium to small-bodied fossil croc in the site because we had all these little scutes, these little bits of armor that were completely different from Deltasuchus. And that pointed to something else being present. I can't say whether or not these things belong to Scolomastax or not because they're not associated. They're not found together. And so subsequent work over the last few years has confirmed the fact that not only do we have Deltasuchus and Scolomastax, but there are actually evidence for two other large fossil crocs there. These ones have been previously described. They're called Woodbinesuchus and Terminonaris.
Okay. Same time period?
Yeah, so these are because they're all found together, these all coexisted roughly around the same time. So we now have, that means we have four different species of crocs living in one place. That kind of diversity, that coexistence, we don't see anything like that in modern ecosystems. At most, you might see two. But a lot of the time, they don't like to share.
So what's it like for someone, yourself, who has an interest in fossils, an interest in the natural sciences, when you realize that you probably have a pretty interesting discovery?
It's
the emotion side?
It's really exciting when you realize that, you know, hey, this is something new that nobody has ever worked on before. And every paleontologist, you know, wants to name a new species. It's really, you know, a great feeling to be able to do that, kind of leave a mark. You know, because that name is hopefully gonna stay with that specimen for you know, forever.
Right.
What was even more fun actually was, as I dove into studying the specimen and trying to figure out as much as I could about it from this one piece, I began to realize just how weird and unique this thing is. So all the stuff that I had said about, you know, the teeth and the shape of the jaw and everything, that's not been seen in any of the closest relatives of Scolomastax. It stands out relative to all the other fossil species that are closely related to it. And that's one of the reasons why it was so difficult to place initially, because it is so different and we had so little of it.
Yeah.
But that was a lot of fun because it actually took me to places where I didn't expect we would end up going when it came to writing the paper and describing it. And so this was supposed to be a quick little paper, like, you know, here's the new species. This is what, you know, what makes it unique. Describe, done. But then it's like, oh, well, it's got these different teeth. And what does that mean? Oh, look at the shape of this jaw. This is completely different from anything else that's, you know, related to it and looks a lot like some of these other weird fossil crocs, looks a little like a mammal. What's going on there? So I learned a lot about the various features that are associated with different traits like omnivory and things like what you see in reptiles both living and extinct that tell you that might be the case. And it was very gratifying to be able to add that dimension to our understanding of this species, because I think it really, pardon the pun, helps flesh out what we what we know about this, and shows you true that no matter, even if it's a small amount of material, you can still learn a lot from it. You don't need a complete skeleton in order to figure out, you know, figure out some very important things about a fossil.
Wow, interesting. How has the work you've done How does that translate, or what are you able to take to, I'll call it your day job, of associate professor of biological sciences? How does it translate into the classroom?
Not directly, but that's partly because right now I primarily teach human anatomy and physiology. However, the anatomy side is always useful, and the more you know about the anatomy of other organisms, that can have some bearing on an understanding of human anatomy. So, I like to share some of those things with my students as appropriate, as time allows. But really, the biggest thing that this work provides is learning opportunities for students who are doing independent study. So students who are looking for a hands-on research experience can come to my lab, and they can help me search for fossils, and they can clean fossils, put them back together, and help me study them. And so this project has provided a number of Parkside students chance to get some hands-on experience with scientific research. And I think that's really been one of the greatest contributions for the campus here.
Sure. And like we were talking before, you have so many samples to work through, right? So having the student assistance, that has to be a good thing for you.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah. And actually they've gone in some very interesting directions. I like to encourage my students to, you know, follow where their interests are and to ask questions and to come up with their own hypotheses and take charge of their own projects. And that's led to some fairly interesting outcomes. I had a student recently who was very interested in the 3D scanning and 3D printing that I also do in my lab, and did a project where he took all the digital models of Deltasuchus that we have, of juvenile Deltasuchus, and put together the first reconstruction of the juvenile skull of Deltasuchus.
Wow.
And I have another student who, after coming out into the field with me, now for the last 3 years has been doing projects related to understanding the preservation of turtle fossils at the site and what that can tell us about the type of environment that existed there at that time. And that's just to name a few.
Yeah. How did you know, and I'm looking at your website where you had, as a young person, you had this interest. What was it that, you know, what do you remember about that interest? Why were you interested, or what were the things that said, oh, I'd really like to find out how this works, or go find that?
Well, you know, the funny thing is, as long as I can remember, I've always wanted to be a paleontologist. My parents tell me that I started saying that when I was 3 years old. So it's been a consistent interest of mine. But I've always been interested in natural history, the natural world, and I've collected all sorts of objects and fossils and things like that. But I really am interested in how animals work, like how does an organism make its living, and how does it relate to its environment? But I'd like to do that with really dead things, so with fossils. Trying to figure out as much as we can about fossil organisms by treating them as if they were once living animals.
Right.
So what were they like when they were alive?
What
sort of ecosystem were they a part of? Because understanding what these ancient ecosystems are like can really inform us about the evolution and change in Earth's biota over time, and how it's responded to various changes in climate and sea level and that sort of thing. and really help us understand why our modern world is the way it is and where it might be going in the future.
Yeah.
And so I've always just found all of those aspects very fascinating. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to be able to turn that into a career.
And not only turn it into a career, but into a career and into discovering something and that you get to name. And that's a pretty interesting career. And you've got a lot more of your career to go. So that's a good thing. Yeah.
And I should point out that this is not all my doing. This project relies on a large number of collaborators, people who are specialists within a variety of fields. Many of them right now are specialists in particular groups of animals. So, for example, I worked with a couple of people who are experts on fossil crocodilians and their close relatives, because I don't have the expertise or the time to become an expert on every single fossil. Group that is represented at the site. So I said we had 2,000. We probably have closer to 4,000 or 5,000 specimens now.
Wow.
And this covers everything from invertebrates, so snails and things like that, to plants, trees, seeds. We've got maybe evidence of some insects, and then we have amphibians and fish, mammals. We might have a snake, which would be really awesome. Turtles, a lot of turtles, more turtles than I ever thought we would have, plus the dinosaurs and the crocs, and who knows what else we may find.
Wow.
So this science is collaborative, because it has to be, because there's more than enough for a whole lifetime for someone if they wanted to work on it. And so I rely on a lot of other people, both professionals and amateurs, to help make this a reality.
Well, it's very exciting. I appreciate you taking some time today to come in to be on Parkside today and tell us about your work in the Dallas Metroplex area, and I'll try to do this right this time, right? The Scolomastex.
Yep.
And not only the Scolomastex, but also the Deltasuchus.
Yep.
I did those better the second time.
Yep, you got
it. Time. So it's been a pleasure to have Associate Professor of Biological Sciences, Dr. Christopher Noto, on Parkside today. Chris, I hope you come back and we can talk more about this soon.
Sure, that would be great. Thanks for having me.